Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Matt Odell, here with me. So first, we've had a bit of a couple crazy days, right? I mean, we had the hysteria of a 12% day that we haven't seen in too much time. BlackRock ETF seems to be inevitable at this point. So I'll start it off there with you. We'll come out the gate. Matt, how you doing? And what do you take of all this hubbub of the BlackRock ETF? Should we be bullish, bearish, worried about the big scary BlackRock coming in, or what?
There's no better drug than waking up in the morning to your net worth being up like 5, 6, 7, 10%. It's like it's the funniest drug too, because there's so many of us that are essentially, you're like taking it at the same time, right? It's like we're all, it's easy to forget about in the bear market. It just, that always feels good. BlackRock, I've been very consistent from the very beginning. It's going to happen. The question is when, not if. BlackRock is the largest fund manager in the world. They're not submitting an ETF unless they have essentially backdoor approval. You know, like they know they're going to get approved. So I think it's going to happen. The question is, when does it happen? When it does happen, I think people will start to really appreciate the scarcity of Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin is there. There's no asset that is as scarce as Bitcoin, and humans have a hard time really comprehending it. I definitely did not fully comprehend. Your mind just can't even adjust to that level of scarcity early on. It just comes over time, and you start to realize as just Bitcoin blows away all your expectations. So I think at least in the short term, BlackRock ETF is incredibly bullish. It brings, you know, billions of dollars that are on the sidelines into Bitcoin exposure. You're not actually owning Bitcoin, you're owning a Bitcoin IOU. But regardless, if BlackRock isn't playing games, there should be underlying Bitcoin that they're purchasing behind the scenes. They might play games at some point. If they do, they'll get blown out, just like BlockFi and FTX and Barry Silbert and Gemini and all these other guys who tried to play games with paper Bitcoin. They'll get blown out eventually, and then Bitcoin marches on. I don't think people really appreciate. I don't know if we've never really had a mainstream ETF launch where the general public can front run the ETF. Maybe you could say, you know, GLD, BlackRock's gold ETF, there's some similarities there, but it's very difficult to stack gold. It's very easy to stack Bitcoin. And in many places of the world, it's just not feasible for you to stack any kind of, you know, amount of exposure to gold. So it's a physical issue, right? You have to get the gold, and you have to store it securely and transport and whatnot. And it makes it very difficult. So we're in a very unique position right now. Until the BlackRock ETF happens, pretty much anyone in the world has the ability to front run the largest fund manager in the world, and all of the institutional money and family offices, all the people that are waiting on the sidelines that just want to call up their broker at UBS or log into their Charles Schwab account or whatever and buy Bitcoin or buy Bitcoin exposure. Once again, not Bitcoin. I think incredibly bullish. It's incredibly bullish, but people should, you know, learn how to hold Bitcoin themselves and learn how to hold it securely. Otherwise they will get rugged eventually. And hopefully the story of the BlackRock ETF isn't a story in 10 years of them playing ridiculous paper Bitcoin games and all that retail money getting just absolutely rugged and realizing, you know, why people self-custody Bitcoin.
Yeah. And I mean, I agree with you there. It is really bullish in the short term for the price. But the question I have is, you know, with FTX and BlockFi and Celsius and all those guys who are kind of playing with those paper Bitcoin games, is it, I mean, obviously it's not a great bet and to give BlackRock money to buy Bitcoin, but is it maybe a safer bet because BlackRock is more SEC regulated in a sense? Or is there still, you know, a pretty good chance that You know, because the SEC is seemingly unable to, I guess, back check or have the capabilities of checking that BlackRock is actually purchasing the Bitcoin, that, you know, it would make it still a hairy game to potentially play.
I would caution people from finding security in regulations and regulators. I will remind people that this last cycle, Gemini advertised themselves as the regulated cryptocurrency exchange, the most regulated in the world. One of the few that can operate in New York. You know, a lot of these Bitcoin websites and services will say, like, citizens, users from North Korea, Iran, and New York aren't allowed to use our service. Gemini had all the boxes checked. DCG, Gemini's partner in their Gemini Earn product, incredibly regulated business. GBTC trades publicly, which is one of the products of DCG. And they lost over $1 billion worth of customer funds. And I think the real issue is there's a fiat mindset, right? Every single bank in America operates under this idea that you're not full reserve, that you play games with customer funds. This is a suit mindset that is going to take years to undo. We heard last cycle over and over again, yield, yield, yield. Let's lend it out to degens. Let's put our money to work. And I think it's going to still take some time for people to wrap their heads around it. I don't think, you know, as a financial asset, Bitcoin is a paradigm shift, right? So it's this, you know, this idea that, first of all, transactions can't be reversed. You can't debase the supply. There's no bailouts. You know, there's no, you know, no printing money to hide all this shit. And I think it will take some time. So I would say that, you know, and then meanwhile, right, some of the bucket shops that are completely unregulated, stuff like, you know, and by the time this podcast is released, maybe Tether blows up, you know, who the fuck knows, but Tether didn't rug, Binance didn't rug, right? But all the suits rugged. Like BlockFi was valued at $4 billion. They fucking rugged. FTX was the fucking darling. They had Tom Brady during the Super Bowl. Gemini, once again, Gemini, Barry. It was a lot of suits rugged this cycle. And some of them, I think, were maybe unintentional. Some of them were, they knew exactly what they were doing. But it comes from this fiat mindset where, like, we just have this Ponzi banking system and everyone's a Ponzi and it's part of the way we do business. And worst comes to worst, if you fuck it up, you're too big to fail and we'll bail it out. The government will bail it out. Taxpayers will bail it out. And that's just not the case in Bitcoin. So there's going to be learning experiences. And we'll see how BlackRock handles that responsibility. But I will say that Bitcoin is unique. Once again, to compare it to gold, Bitcoin is unique in the fact that it's very easy to purchase it and take self-custody. And what does that do? What that does is if you have these dedicated stackers, you have these people that just, they want to store their wealth in Bitcoin. I'm one of them, right? They want to store their wealth in Bitcoin. They don't want their wealth to erode over time. They want to be able to pass it down to future generations. We're out there stacking sats and taking it into self-custody. And what that does is it creates this upwards price pressure. And it doesn't matter how much paper games you play and you try and suppress the price, you try and do all this stuff. Eventually, if you play those games, you're short Bitcoin, you will get blown out. And it might be painful for people. We might have short-term price corrections where you go from, you know, theoretically 69,000 all the way back down to 15,000. But in the long term, those people will get blown out if they play those games. And that's the solace I find, right? Like the people that are like, the BlackRock ETF is horrible for Bitcoin. They're going to try and suppress the price. They're going to do all this stuff. All of this shit was inevitable. Like if Bitcoin can't handle an ETF, then we never had a fucking chance at all creating a independent, you know, financial asset and monetary network. Like it just was never going to fucking happen. It's like the bare minimum. And it operates under that key premise. Like the key premise is, first of all, it's incredibly easy to self-custody. It's incredibly easy to run your own node and verify what is actually going on behind the scenes. And then Yeah, and just this idea that if you own more Bitcoin, it doesn't give you more control over the network. BlackRock can accumulate as much Bitcoin as they want. They can't force changes as a result of that Bitcoin accumulation.
But what does that do for like the circular economy aspect of things, like spending Bitcoin? Because, you know, I don't know. To me, it seems like there's kind of, I guess, two schools of thought here, right? I mean, like the Western, like the United States, for example, is very much like hodl your Bitcoin, don't ever spend it, that kind of mindset. Whereas like, you know, some other places, remittances, maybe using the Lightning Network, that's obviously developing very quickly. Spending Bitcoin is kind of maybe more of like a grassroots movement. And so like, you know, doesn't the BlackRock ETF in a sense almost kind of halt that? Because, you know, you have basically one of the bigger players in the financial industry, maybe even the biggest, essentially getting a bunch of dollars to fund to purchase Bitcoin and essentially hold it themselves.
So, I mean, my thesis on Bitcoin is this idea that my thesis on freedom tech in general is that is the idea that if you build it, they will come. And it is based on this underlying idea concept that if people need something, they will figure out how to make it happen. Right. And so it's important here to split it up. It's important here to split up essentially two bifurcated markets, right? In the developed world, in the developing world, there is a strong need for an independent money. There's a lot of failed government money out there. If you're in Argentina, if you're in many places in Africa, if you're in Turkey, if you're in Russia, you have a very horrible money, right? And you have a need to be able to transact globally and have an alternative, and they figure it out. They figure out Bitcoin. Circular economy in those areas tends to be doing much better than circular economy. This idea of spending and earning Bitcoin has tended to perform much better in the developing world because they don't have many alternatives. In America, in Europe, you know, fiat is still a shitcoin. The dollar is a shitcoin. Euro is a shitcoin. It's not something good to save in. But we have a lot of options available to us. We have Apple Pay. We have credit cards. We have the ability to buy, you know, S&P 500 index funds to try and preserve our wealth or real estate or whatever different mechanisms you want to do to try and preserve your wealth. We have many options. That's our privilege, right? So you have two different markets. Now, in the developed world, people have been saying for the longest time, we need a circular economy. It's one of my main goals. Like, I would love to be able to just never sell Bitcoin and just spend it, right? It takes away that pressure on this idea of on-ramps and off-ramps, like these companies that connect you to the fiat system and have KYC and regulatory capture and all these other fucking issues. But I think in the developed world, what is going to push people forward in terms of actually being able to go and spend my Bitcoin at a hardware store or something is this idea that the small business owner, at least in the beginning, the idea that the small business owner wants to accumulate Bitcoin themselves. This idea that, you know, we're running Bitcoin Park, this community supported campus in Nashville. This idea that as a founding partner of Bitcoin Park, like I want sats, I want to earn sats. So of course I'm going to accept Bitcoin. And I don't really care what kind of friction that involves because I just want the Bitcoin. And I think there might be an argument. I think there is an argument that these two things aren't necessarily opposed. It's not mutually exclusive. This idea of Bitcoin increasing in purchasing power versus spending Bitcoin. Because good money should accrue value over time. It should at the very least not lose value over time. And you should be able to save it without permission. And you also need to be able to spend it without permission, because if you can't spend it without permission, then it's worthless to you. You don't actually have anything. So you need both for a good money. And I think if the ETF, you know, increases the purchasing power of Bitcoin, it means that there's more people that are willing to accept it and hold it and then spend it in the future and deal with that friction because their purchasing power is increasing, right? A lot of us have gotten first based on this idea of Bitcoin purchasing power increasing, or the idea of getting wealthy, right? So if that mints more Bitcoiners And then Bitcoiners, as small business owners, are the most likely to start a circular economy in America, then maybe it actually helps. Now, this is completely exclusive of the fact that there are different scenarios that I've been watching for a while where you pair something like the ETF with horrible regulation in the United States, right? Where you like essentially criminalize private Bitcoin usage. You say, you know, if you self-custody, you're going to deal with all this additional friction. So then just most people just hold the ETF. And obviously you can't go to your local hardware store and spend the ETF to buy something. So if that's where most people, if there's regulations combined with it, you could have a situation where private Bitcoin usage is essentially outlawed in the United States. And it's one thing, like essentially criminalized. It's harder to enforce, but make you a de facto criminal if you're holding Bitcoin outside of these regulated institutions and spending it outside of the regulated institutions at the same time as the ETF is pumping the price. And there's a whole group of Bitcoiners that will just think it's bullish, right? And the word you'll hear is regulatory clarity, and it's opened up all these new doors and yada, yada, yada. So it should be interesting to see how it plays out, but I don't think it's necessarily negative for circular economy in America. And it's important to realize that we have really made very little progress in terms of being able to spend Bitcoin in America. So it's hard to imagine it being worse.
Yeah, that's a fair point. But, you know, you kind of brought up the grassroots movement, and I want to take a dive into that because, you know, I think that whole dichotomy around Bitcoin kind of embracing the grassroots movement is very interesting because, you know, in a sense, the internet was supposed to bring us together as a globe, right? I mean, like we're connecting here from two different cities, right? It would take an airplane for me to get to Nashville right now. I'm in Tampa. And, you know, vice versa, or a very long drive. I could have this conversation with somebody in Europe at, you know, the same time or something like that. Whereas, and same with Bitcoin, right? I mean, we could send Bitcoin to each other instantly through through, you know, a simple Lightning transaction that would take seconds. But in a sense, it's kind of flipped on its head, right? I mean, we're now bringing it back to the communities and making sure that the communities are kind of building up before, I guess, maybe the globalization aspect, or maybe I'm just viewing this incorrectly. But, you know, I guess, like, I appreciate the stress when it comes to the grassroots movement, because I think you should really take care of your community first and foremost. But, you know, I guess, like, where did the dichotomy of this come from when, you know, essentially, like, the internet was almost supposed to bring us together, you know, I guess, as a globe at first? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a little bit before my time. But like the internet was essentially like a US government invention. Right. And so when the rollout of that happened, it was a very permissioned rollout in the beginning. You know, it was, you would have different institutions in the US. They would all peer together. They'd have these massive computers. It was a lot of colleges, right? Universities that were a part of it. And they have that like famous chart or whatever, where you like see it's like there's like seven hops on the internet, right? And then like in 10 years later, 20 years later, you have the global internet. Bitcoin's a little bit different than that, right? Because Bitcoin is this idea of this freedom tech project, this completely free and open source project that just gets released to the world anonymously. And then people have to figure out what to do with it. And I think what's really powerful about it is this idea that you don't have to ask permission. There's no top-down kind of scenario, right? It's really adoption is driven by individuals around the world that choose to pick a better option and take a better path. And then at scale together, it ends up being incredibly effective and actionable, right? But the key aspect is it just comes down to that individual who wants to opt into that system. So I think as a result, what we'll see is it has to start from grassroots. It has to, at the core of society, like that is how we interact with people, is mostly local. And it just comes with this added benefit that you can also send money around the world and leverage, you know, the fact that we already have the internet and whatnot. But when you think about like how people interact with money, it's mostly local. right?
Yeah, I mean, that is true, right? I mean, going to your grocery store, going to a local restaurant, even though with the, I guess, the added online shopping aspects of things, if somebody can go down the street or walk across the street for something, they're going to do that. Nobody's going to go order a hot coffee off the internet or something like that, right? But it is kind of
interesting. Like what? Like 95% of my transactions, not just Bitcoin, all financial transactions, sending money to someone else. Was it like maybe like 99% are Americans? And then like 95% are Tennesseans, and then 90% are Nashvillians, right? Like that's like actual my payment breakdown. And maybe you're right. Maybe for a lot of people, 30% of it will be Amazon, right? Like that's the outlier. But I just, there's another aspect here where like, yeah, like maybe in your head, you're like, oh, like Amazon should just add Lightning payments, right? And the big guys aren't going to do it first, just period. They have product, they have complete market domination. They have absolutely nothing to gain. They have very little to gain. They have everything to lose. And what you see is this type of technology is like almost, it's like challengers adopt it first. Even someone like Cash App, right? Cash App's $80 billion. I don't know what, their market cap is massive, publicly traded company. But Venmo was first. Venmo was above them. And Cash App needed something to challenge Venmo, to try and take market share away from Venmo. So Cash App added Bitcoin, right? And I think we just see that repeat over and over again. And in that way, like a lot of times it's just going to happen local, small businesses. Like that's where it starts. That's where the momentum starts until people can't ignore it.
Yeah, that's fair. And, you know, I guess kind of like adding on to that point, I was listening to the Thriller Bitcoin podcast with Carr and Michael from Oshi, Michael Atwood, and he was kind of describing Apple Pay in a sense too, because, you know, obviously like, you know, majority of Americans have an iPhone, maybe not a lot of, you know, Bitcoiners, but majority of Americans have an iPhone, which, you know, essentially you could connect your debit credit card to your Apple Pay, just double tap, put it up to a register, pretty easy to use. But those transactions now, I think like they say, merchants say like less than 10% of all transactions take place on Apple Pay, which has been around, I think, for like, I want to say like 7 or 8 years. So, you know, it's something that too, I think, it's not only just, you know, obviously encouraging people to spend Bitcoin and use that circular economy, but it's also going to take like kind of a human behavior change of sorts, right? I mean, maybe it's going to take a merchant only accepting Bitcoin before, you know, we kind of get to that circular economy, maybe like locally. So, you know, I kind of agree with you where it's going to maybe the big players like an Amazon or somebody, they really have no incentive to do it. But the local people, you know, I'm sure like at Bitcoin Park, obviously you guys have Bitcoin Preferred and all that kind of stuff. And I would imagine that, you know, that encourages more people to use Bitcoin just because of the community that you guys have built there. But, you know, on that note, I guess one, like, how do you think the development of that has, I guess, shifted and made more people pay with Bitcoin? And two, like, do you think that it's brought and kind of helped build the Bitcoin Park community and made it, I guess, a little bit closer in a sense?
So we, like Nashville, come visit us. Bitcoin Park is special. We have events that are free all throughout the year. We have some paid events too. We have a great membership base. They're always hanging out here, working here. I'm recording here from now Bitcoin Park. But one of our great shames, man, is... it has been, Bitcoin Park has been open for 14 months now. I've been in Nashville for 2 years. We don't have many merchants that accept Bitcoin. And I it's just a timing thing. You can't force anyone to do it. And it makes a lot of sense to me that it's going to come from merchant first. The few merchants we have, they're ride or die Bitcoiners. Of course they accept Bitcoin. Like if they can get some no KYC sats, even if it's just 5%, or 2% of their monthly revenue, like that's a win for them, right? If they want to offer a discount, that's a win for them. I mean, just think about it from there's like basic principles, right? First hardware store in Nashville that accepts Bitcoin is going to do pretty well for themselves. the fourth, probably not going to move the needle at all. And that's kind of where we are right now. And it's just, you got to kind of just, and on the spending side, right, what we really see in most of the world, this one crosses both developing world and developed world, is that one of the first things is the spender, for the most part, needs to have a majority of Bitcoin in terms of their savings. Once you have a majority of Bitcoin in your savings, you have no choice. You're either selling it or spending it. You have no choice but to use it, right? It's one of the privileged things that Americans and Europeans say when they're like, why would I spend Bitcoin when I can spend my fiat? Well, you know, if first of all, if that's the case, you're short Bitcoin because you have all this fiat lying around that you're spending on Amazon. But that's like, once you're 95% in Bitcoin, 98% of Bitcoin, you're going to figure it out. And what that means is, a lot of times, is all these hacks, you know, like gift cards and cash trades and all this different stuff, which kind of alleviates the pressure from the spending side. The people that really need it on the spending side, just they figure out how to do it through like crazy means. But on the receiving side, on the merchant side, I think that's probably where we start to see. That's probably where we start to see a jumpstart in the developed world. Just merchant Bitcoiners wanting to receive Bitcoin, you know, they run a grocery store, they run a hardware store, a plumber, and they want to receive Bitcoin. They offer a discount. Maybe they'll offer like 5% discount because they want those no KYC sats. And that's probably where we start to see it happen. And I don't see how BlackRock really impacts that. Like, that doesn't really change it much.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, like, yeah, more businesses, as more people become Bitcoiners, more business owners will become Bitcoiners as well. And I think, you know, yeah, the small business incentives are just, you know, obviously they're there, right? I mean, cutting out the 3% to 7 or 8% fee on a credit card transaction, to say the very least, would be enticing for sure. But, you know, you've kind of alluded to the free open source software movement of things, right? And, you know, you've been very vocal about Nostr and kind of the development of that, and very anti-blue check on Twitter. So I kind of want to ask, like, you know, why the anti-blue check first? And then I kind of want to dive into Nostr a little bit afterwards.
First of all, I've been very consistent on my anti-blue check philosophy. I actually was looking, back to Twitter in 2021. I was like looking back through my Twitter history, and like, I was shitting on blue checks left and right back then. So just, this is a pre-Elon phenomenon, for what it's worth. My issue post-Elon, and my issue with blue checks in general was that, you know, they thought they were better than us because they did KYC, right? Like, the way you used to get a blue check was, first of all, Twitter would grace you, right? Pre-Elon, Twitter would grace you with significance. You were a journalist or a rich person or some shit. And then they would be like, take a picture of your ID and email it to us. Like, I got offered a blue check. I was like, I'm not KYCing for Twitter. But now Elon allows anyone to buy it. And it still involves KYC, tying your personal identifiable information. But the real dark fucking pattern, the real fucked up part, is that you get better engagement. It encourages people to give up their ID for more likes, more retweets, more reach. It's literally there when you go to sign up. It's like, we will boost you. And what that means is, it's essentially shadow banning people that don't want to tie their legal identity to Twitter. So I think that's incredibly dangerous. He also added this monetary incentive, right? Where once you do that, you also get a cut of the ad revenue. And it's really dark. I think people just, I've always been concerned about social media and these big tech companies. And we just haven't realized, like, the repercussions. We haven't seen the repercussions yet. And It's bad. Like, people are addicted to it. The incentives are all fucked up. And it's incredibly bad for people. And I think specifically, like, if you care about freedom, there's like this whole breed of freedom influencers on Twitter. They're fucking hypocrites. They're complete hypocrites. Like, everyone wants to rail against CBDCs. They want to rail against all this other shit. Will we see CBDCs, central bank digital currencies? Maybe. What is more likely in America is that we see, you know, corporate versions of payment tech that are digital, which we've already started to see with the Venmos of the world and the PayPals of the world that are surveilled, controlled, all this other shit. And maybe CBDs happen and all those wallets will integrate it, right? So I could see Twitter becoming, I'm not even speculating. Like, Elon has said it himself. He wants it to be WeChat of the West. He wants it to have payments and he wants your whole life to be dependent on it. He wants your social credit score. You know, what are you tweeting? How much engagement are you getting? Should you get the home loan? You know, it gets dark really fucking quick. And I think at some point people need to practice civil disobedience and choose when enough is enough. And a man has to have his code. So I don't use Twitter anymore. I wanted to go out on my terms. I didn't want him to just shadow ban me into insignificance or ban my account or whatever. I just wanted to walk away from what he's doing. And I think people just, that goes with my bull case for Bitcoin. It's just like, people will realize the need eventually and they'll seek out better alternatives. And people will realize the need for communication protocols that are open, like Nostr, rather than completely closed platforms that are censored and manipulated. And unfortunately, it's going to be very painful. The process is going to be very painful. But yeah, I think, I don't know, dude. I'm like an accidental influencer. I hate the fucking term influencer because I personally don't want people to be influenced by me. I want them to make their own decisions and practice personal responsibility, but the incentives are the opposite. The incentives are, be completely dependent on me so I can monetize you to your fullest. And Elon's Twitter has taken that to 11, right? Like, they've gone full stack ahead. You get paid for engagement. You get paid for all this shit. You don't get paid for telling the truth. You don't get paid for being an honest actor. It's the opposite. It's like, there was already some bad incentives there. And he was like, that's a feature, not a bug. And he like made it even fucking worse. And I think we'll see the repercussions of this like influencer mindset. Like, most of these people are like waking up in the morning and they're like taking for gospel like what these social media influencers are saying. It's like self-help social media influencers that are addicted to social media. And like, you just shouldn't be taking advice from them. And I think at scale, like, it really hurts society. So we'll see how it works out. I think it's going to be a fucking mess. I'm glad Nostr's there as a option that's being built out in parallel so people don't have to rely on this shit. But yeah, just to wrap it all up, like, I think at its core, most humans are hypocrites. I'm a hypocrite all the time. But I think what differentiates people is people who actually don't want to be a hypocrite and try and reduce their hypocrisy as much as possible and try and practice what they preach and not be, you know, not be a bullshitter, right? And there's a whole set of people, like, society really just rewards you for being full of shit right now. And like, that's how our incentives are set up.
Yeah. No, I mean, I definitely, you know, I hear you out on all that. And it, you know, that whole like thesis is, you know, obviously pretty doom and gloom when it comes to social media. But I mean, it's, you know, we've seen it, whether you believe the rumors of the election and that kind of like meddling and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you could easily see how that can be done in such like a centralized entity and where the way people get so dependent on social media. But, you know, in a sense, like, I guess, I see the capabilities of Nostr and I see kind of like the development on it, but maybe I might be missing something. Like, is Nostr's like full capability maybe like a Twitter type of replacement, or what do you foresee as like the open availability of Nostr? And maybe we haven't even gotten to where it can all be just yet, but where do you kind of see this technology kind of going?
I think it's hard to comprehend like the potential of Nostr. Like, Nostr is so much more than a Twitter competitor. It can be used as a Twitter competitor. It can be used as an Instagram competitor. It can be used as a Reddit competitor. It can be used as a competitor to all of these centralized platforms. But at its core, it's this open, interoperable, permissionless communication protocol. And it can be used for all sorts of different communication. And it's quite simple and it's quite robust, which is really good to see. That's what you want to see. When you make shit complex, it just, there's all these edge cases, huge attack surface, hard to integrate. But like, we're already starting to see some of these interesting applications for it. You know, the guys at Mutiny Wallet, for instance, if you just put in a Nostr public key, you have almost a Venmo-like experience. You see all your contacts, you see who you can pay, without relying on a centralized platform. They didn't have to go and sign a deal with Elon and get access to the API and put a login with Twitter button and sign a bunch of legal docs and an NDA or whatnot. They just integrated Nostr, an open communication protocol. And I think when you mix that with an open monetary network, right, you have really, really, like, the world is your oyster. You have there's so much capabilities there. So I will say that I think it's incredibly powerful as a Twitter competitor. It's incredibly powerful as an Instagram competitor. But that pales into comparison to what we will see in terms of other use cases that rely on communication. Almost everything we use on our phones relies on some level of communication, right? And that can use, a lot of it can use Nostr, particularly like social graphs, stuff like that. Like, you can release, and here's the thing too, the blue checks on Twitter who are like, I am not bullish on Nostr as a Twitter competitor, but I'm bullish on Nostr as something that you integrate into Bitcoin wallets and all these different apps and stuff. It's the same, and that's the same fallacy that people make with, I'm bullish on Bitcoin as savings, but not as a spending technology. Like, you need both. And like, the reason it's powerful for non-social media uses is because the social graph is built out in the social media use cases. Like, if when you go into Mutiny and you put in an NPub and you get that social graph, you get everyone you follow, everything, whatnot. Like, the reason that exists is because you were using it as a Twitter competitor. So you have the social graph. And just think about that capability. Think about the idea that a developer anywhere in the world, some poor developer in the Philippines, can release an app that is Nostr capable. All of a sudden, instead of needing to go from zero in terms of users, they have millions of pub keys that are, you know, millions of users that are already have social graphs and stuff. They can just sign in with their Nostr key. They put in their Nostr private key or Nostr public key, depending on the use case. And then all of a sudden, they have access to this full network graph. So they can build whatever they want. They don't have to do the user adoption thing where they're trying to get from zero to 100. And then they can monetize with freedom money. And they can actually make money from people around the world without signing deals with Visa and fucking Swift and all this fiat payment crap. Like, all of a sudden, you cut out the Twitter API, you cut out the bank API, and you're literally able to build whatever fucking app you want. And you have communications and money, and you can monetize it on top of that. Like, that's fucking crazy. Like, I feel like people are really sleeping on that. But I also at the same time will defend it as a Twitter competitor. Like, I think the simple fact that if you rely on one of these centralized social media platforms, you can just get rugged at will. People will learn. They'll touch the stove, they'll get rugged, and they'll be like, I want to use unruggable technology. Right? Like, I don't want to spend 5 years building up an audience and just having it ripped out from underneath me because the YouTube censorship department decides that I said wrong think. Like, that's insane. And I think, you know, I don't, and this is where I argue with a lot of Noster diehards, is like, I don't think I need to post on Twitter or TikTok about it. Like, you know, the normies will figure it out. They will get rugged. The people they listen to will get rugged, and they will figure out Bitcoin and Noster. Like, that is a very paternalistic idea that we need to, like, guide them in everything. Like, people figure shit out when they need to. And that's why I'm bullish on Bitcoin. Like, if we needed to go on TikTok and release videos, like catchy videos with open mouths and shit to get people to use Bitcoin, we're fucked. Like, that, I would not be bullish. Same with Noster.
Yeah, that's fair to say. But I mean, I'll play devil's advocate with you on the Twitter replacement, is that, you know, don't you think that, you know, the reason why people, you know, essentially spend hours on Twitter or on social media in general, just because of the algorithm and they're addicted to it. So, like, I guess where, in a sense, I mean, like, you could essentially build up an audience in Noster. Like, you've done it, Marty's done it, Preston Pish has done it, a lot of people have done it, right? And it seems like it's kind of transferred from one social media over to Noster because that's where you guys live. And yeah, like you said, people figured it out. If they want to understand where your head's at or whatever, they'll find you on Noster. But, you know, I guess from somebody kind of, I guess, starting from like the ground up, or so to speak, or some, like, you know, a smaller person, it seems like it's a little bit more difficult to build up the audience on, you know, maybe on a Noster, or, you know, people just aren't on it as much because, you know, the algorithm, and they're just, you know, simply just not as addicted. Obviously, the not addicted part is the positive, but I guess, like, I don't know, like, seeing the Twitter replacement thing, for me, I guess it, maybe it would make a more productive society, but it just, like, that's where I guess maybe I'm missing something there.
Yeah. So there's two things. First off, Noster is still incredibly young. Like, it's brand new. Like, adoption is going to take some time. There are there's significantly less people using it. You know, Primal, if you go to primal.net/explore, they say there's 33 million created accounts, but less than 500K, like, active real humans, whatever. So, like, if you think about it on the scale wise, like, I don't know how many users Facebook, Instagram, Twitter have, but it's hundreds of millions, if not billions, right? Like, they have lots of users. So that's going to take a little bit of time. On the algorithm side, Noster isn't anti-algorithm necessarily. It's this idea that you can choose your algorithm. So there will be algorithms. And since it's so early, we don't see that many, but those algorithms will compete on a marketplace. And if you don't like your algorithm one day, you wake up in the morning and you're like, you know, Pablo's maintaining my algorithm and I don't like it, you can switch to someone else's algorithm, or you could choose no algorithm and just do the chronological feed. And it's important to realize that that algorithm, by the way, is like one of the key attack surfaces in terms of regulatory capture with the centralized social media companies, is the fact that Twitter chooses what you see means that regulators want to push them to show you what they want you to see, right? That they become party to this process. In the early days of Twitter, there was no algorithm. It was just like straight up chronological feed. But with Noster, you will have the choice. You can choose no algorithm. You can choose any algorithm you want. You can mix and match them. You can have you can use multiple different apps. They all interact with the same followers and stuff. So I think you start to see that. And then, those are my two answers, but I will just add a third answer, which is, I think people are underestimating the ability to shitpost without limits. And it's a very easy for techie people and developers and nerds and engineers to be like, we need to engineer the perfect solution. But Twitter's not perfect. Facebook's not perfect. TikTok's not perfect. They were good enough and people started to use them. And what do you see see a horrible user experience on Twitter, but people use it because they have no better option, right? You see people, I mean, the big one for me is always American HODL, right? It was like American HODL 1 got banned. He created American HODL 2. Then he created American HODL 3. He is like up to like American HODL 9 or 10 or something, right? Like, he just, his account keeps getting banned. So he just creates a new one. At some point, I think Noster will be built out to the point, and we're getting close. It's extremely user friendly, and you don't need permission to use it. So you can post whatever the fuck you want to post. And like some people will post illegal things or whatever, and you know, the local police will arrest them. This idea that like you have to censor it at the point of speech is like a thought crime kind of scenario, right? It's like, we got to stop them from ever even committing the crime, is insane. We've never done that ever in humanity until the digital era. Like, well, we've never been in this situation before. So I think people will just naturally come around to it. And I think it's fine if you believe that's far off. But I will say that at least own the fact that the reason you're still using Twitter, the reason you're still using TikTok, the reason you're still using Instagram is because you love that dopamine hit of someone pressing like or retweet. And you're not really, it's not really about providing value to the world. That's just like a bullshit virtue signal thing you're doing. Because if your content actually provides value to people, they will use Nostr. They will figure it out. They will use your email newsletter or whatever. They will watch your podcast. Like, that's what'll happen. And it's really just a bunch of people deluding themselves into thinking that they're not completely addicted to the dopamine hit that is social media. And I would just, it would make me feel better inside if the people I respect just admitted that's why they do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's 100% fair to say, right? I mean, obviously it's the algorithm, the dopamine hit too, getting those likes, retweets, all that kind of stuff too. But, and I think in a sense, Nostr, yeah, I mean, I could see how you can get the dopamine hits from a similar experience on Nostr too, with like the zaps feature and everything like that, right?
I mean, likes and reposts and whatnot too.
Yeah, yeah, that those as well. But, you know, I guess how big of a, I guess, red flag, or maybe it was like a good flag, or, you know, I guess of whatever, a signal, so to speak, of Apple trying to ban Domus to try to get away from, you know, the zaps and just obviously the growing use of Nostr on that, because, you know, obviously Twitter, you know, tried to implement tips at some point in time, and it seemed like Apple didn't really have an issue with that. But now, I don't know if, you know, if Apple was getting a cut of those or whatnot, or the
I think they were getting a cut. That's the key. It's like, first of all, like, Apple is a problem. They're a walled garden. You use Apple products with their permission. They can ban all Bitcoin apps. You know, they can ban all Nostr apps. What we've seen on the Nostr side is it's really mostly about their cut. They usually get a 30% cut of in-app purchases. Apple's behind the times. They don't accept Bitcoin payments. So it's hard for Nostr or Bitcoin apps to give them a 30% of in-app transactions. I think Apple will probably come around eventually, and it'll actually make it way easier for them to monetize with these developers, because you can be a developer anywhere in the world and you can send them a cut with Bitcoin payments. You can just do like a zap split or whatever. They can receive on Lightning, you know. How many years is that? I don't fucking know. But I will say, like, it just goes back, like, it goes back to those two themes that we've talked about multiple times already in this conversation is, first of all, if people need it, they will figure it out. I have a buddy who is a, TikTok influencer. I give him shit about it all the time, obviously. But he uses a different phone when he does his TikTok influencing, right? Like, he's an influencer and, you know, he makes a decent amount of money from doing his TikTok videos, but he understands the Chinese government is spying on everything he does. So he went out and he bought an Android phone for $200 that he just uses for TikTok. To be able to ship posts without limits, people might have to buy an Android phone or use a computer, you know, to do it. And that'll just be the middle phase, you know, or the early phase to middle phase before Apple has no choice but to support it, because people are like literally going out and buying Samsung phones instead of using Apple because they don't support the largest social network in the world. So like, that'll just be the case. And then the second theme that we keep talking about is this idea of challengers. You know, it's not going to be Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan's going to sign a $200 million Spotify exclusive deal. It's going to be the guys that are six levels below Joe Rogan. You know, six levels even below someone like Tim Pool or something like that. they're the ones who are going to move to Nosta first because they have nothing to lose and everything to gain. And they'll set, you know, that's how the adoption starts in the beginning. It'll be the challengers. When Tucker Carlson, you know, he left Fox and now he's on Twitter only. Like, he's never getting censored. Like, if he had an issue, he just calls up Elon and be like, yo, dude, why the fuck is my account banned? And he'll be back on, right? But the people seven rungs below him might. And I think that's where you start to see it. You start to see it on the audience side. And I think Bitcoiners, the Bitcoin influencers are going to start to see it this cycle. Bull market's going to get lit. And every single one of these Bitcoin influencers, they ride or die based on, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of plebs that retweet and like their shit. And if they're on Nostr, they're not going to get the engagement that they're used to, right? The beast is going to get starved. So I think you see it from the challengers. You don't see it from the large accounts. You're not going to see it from the large. There's going to be anomalies, right? Like Snowden uses Nostr. Dorsey, like, obviously has a lot of pent up shit with Twitter and he uses Nostr heavily. But you'll mostly see it on the smaller accounts, and that's where it'll happen until everyone can't ignore it. And also a lot of these people use multiple, right? So that'll probably be the middle ground. Another thing I've been watching is, there's like this critical mass number. I don't know what it is. I don't think it's an objective number, but this critical mass number that if you, a critical mass of Nostr adoption, where if I post something on Nostr, I have a reasonable expectation that if it's interesting, people will cross post it across all the shitty social media sites and vice versa. If something is interesting that is posted on a centralized social media platform, someone will post it on Nostr so they can get the Nostr engagement and the zaps and all that shit. And you already see that in the centralized landscape. Like, I've never used TikTok in my life. Like, how many times does a blue check, you know, tweet out some screen cap of a TikTok video that is going viral on TikTok because they want the engagement on Twitter, right? And so we don't necessarily need 100% of people to use Nostr, right? There's that critical mass number where you hit a high enough critical mass and you don't have to go into any other app to, you know, figure out what the fuck is going on and whatever the latest war is, or, you know, why T-bills are going down or some shit. Because someone will have cross-posted to Nostr. And if you post something interesting to Nostr, they will send it out to all the normies on all the other social media so that they can get the engagement.
Yeah, that's true. I think I've seen like a few of your like just Nostr posts just floating around screen grabs on Twitter as well. So, I mean, I could definitely foresee that, you know, kind of being it there in a sense. And, you know, I know like, you see similar memes everywhere as well. So, I mean, I think that's just kind of like par for the course, exactly like you're saying. But
the TikTok videos do you see on Twitter?
Yeah, all the time.
It's big now. Like, they're all over the place.
Yeah. And I don't think that's going to slow down. I think that's just going to accelerate, right? I mean, I think it's just that, like, a couple people are there. Yeah, I mean, as you said, the incentives are there to try to, you know, go viral on Twitter in a sense. So, I mean, like, it's just going to continue to happen.
Dude, right? When I was using Twitter, people would take my high engagement posts. Like, they would go back in my, I call people all the time fucking doing this. They would go into my, like, my history, my Twitter history. They would sort by likes. And they would take a post that fucking banged and they would just reword it slightly. And they'd post it on the same exact fucking platform because the incentives are so strong that if it's good information, if it's something that people want, people will repost it. And that's in like within the same platform. That's not even cross platform. So we'll just see more of that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. I agree with you. So, but before I let you go, I want to ask one last question. You know, I mean, obviously, you got a lot of exposure to Bitcoiners, a lot of people in general there at Bitcoin Park. Is there any like specific project, maybe it's Nostr related or Bitcoin related, that gets you really bullish? Obviously, you got 1031 too, so maybe you're limited on some of the things you could say. But if you could dive into any project that you got that somebody's building and that, you know, has you really bullish going forward. Yeah, feel free to take a dive in. Maybe it's not even a specific project. Maybe it's just, you know, something in general too.
Yeah, I mean, Brandon mentioned 1031, which is the Bitcoin-only venture fund that I helped launch. You can find more information about that at 1031.vc. But you did mention that, like, maybe that, you know, prevents me from speaking freely. And I can proudly say that it hasn't prevented me from speaking freely at all. I don't know. I'm excited about a lot of different things. I'm really like the Nostr ecosystem, like Primal. I'm super fucking excited about Primal.net. Is this idea of a Nostr? It's like, and this is the thing. It's like trade-offs all the way down, always, right? And this is, you know, what's cool. But like Primal wants to build a Twitter killer, and to some Nostr people, it's not purely Nostr. It's not like the pure unadulterated Nostr. They want to have an algorithm. You can opt in or out of the algorithm. And they put a server in between you and all these different distributed relays. And what does that mean? When you add the server in between, which is completely open source, to make sure that it's trust minimized, make sure there's no regulatory capture and regulatory pressure, means that you might have an experience that's actually faster and better UX than Twitter. Like, it's not just for the freedom. It's not just a shit post without limits. It's actually just a better fucking experience all over. So Milan and his team over at Primal, I'm super excited about. I've always loved the team at BTC Pay Server, like circular economy stuff. I'm really excited about. The boys at Mutiny Wallet are fucking crushing it. And like that overlap between Bitcoin and Nostr is something I've been really watching. Also, like, it sounds super hype, but that overlap between AI, Nostr, and Bitcoin, where like you're paying AI with Bitcoin because it's the best money in the world. And of course, that's what you would want to do if you're dealing with computers and algorithms and stuff and APIs. And then the communication is happening over Nostr. It's like this crazy trifecta. So there's a couple companies that are like projects that are like in that space. We have Pablo with the data vending machine concept, which is basically that concept. It's an open source. It's something that anyone can integrate. They can create all these different data vending machines where they communicate over Nostr, paid with Bitcoin. Pretty crazy. I just had Evan from Zeus on Citadel Dispatch, one of my shows. He figured out how to do self-custody Lightning addresses on mobile. It's a big deal. There's so much stuff. It's when you're in the weeds, it's hard not to be bullish all the time. Like, we're building the future. I'm just trying my best to play that tiny little small part in it all. But at the end of the day, like, all I really care about is it sounds corny. All I really care about is freedom. We have no other option. If we don't have freedom options, if we don't have freedom tech, the alternative is incredibly dark. And people say, like, I'm a doomer and all this other stuff. But ultimately my take is optimism. It's just, we're going to go through a dark period, and we can reduce the amount of darkness, and we can have paths to light. And that seems like the best fucking option for us, period. There's a lot of teams building just really fucking cool things. The no KYC, like P2P trading stuff, is really cool. A lot of different trade-off balances, RoboSats, Peach, HODL, Bisc. And it's cool that they're all like, when you have these like open, I'm just ranting. When you have these like open permissionless protocols, what that means is that, first of all, anyone can build on them without permission. And then users have like ridiculous amounts of choices. And this is what Bitcoin Twitter or Bitcoin Nostr or Bitcoin Reddit or Bitcoin IRC, like where we all like to argue with each other. This is where a lot of people miss it, right? It's like, you don't have to agree with every tool or project or what trade-offs they make. The cool part is that we can choose which one we want. Like, I can shit on Wallet of Satoshi all the time because I think they're going to rug people and they might shotgun KYC or whatever. But it's cool that you can use a custodial wallet from some random ass Australian company, or you can use a self-custody wallet from Evan with Zeus or the Mutiny Boys, and you have that choice and they're all interoperable. Like, that is just, it blows my mind that that's possible. And so I just hope we're going to live in a world where users have many, many options. People have many, many options. And that includes choosing your own money. And that includes having freedom of speech protected by code, not by corrupt politicians.
Yeah, man, I love that. And I think that's a great place to wrap it. So I appreciate you highlighting all those great projects and great things going on. So I'll give you a chance if you want it, you could have it to shill all the stuff you got going on. Obviously, we mentioned 1030 Roll and Citadel Dispatch a little bit already. But yeah, man, where can they find you and figure out all that you've got going on?
Look, I don't need you. If you're addicted to social media, I don't make your own decision. Check out Nostr. Consider checking out Nostr. You can find me on Nostr at primal.net/Odell. I have all relevant links at odell.xyz. No one is going to save you. You have to save yourself. You have to figure it out. You're going to figure it out eventually. I have faith that you'll figure it out eventually. People do a lot of hard things in their lives, and they do it because they have no choice and they need to do it. It's on you. Do better. And if you need any help, there are so many of us in this community that will help you. So don't hesitate to reach out. I know Brandon mentioned Carr from Pleb Lab and the Thriller Bitcoin podcast. Me and him actually connected through one of the Pleb Lab chats. Pleb Lab is a perfect example. It's just like, they just care. They're people that care, and they're ready to answer your questions. And there's many of us out there, so just don't get overwhelmed. And just help out your fellow human.
Yep, help out your fellow human and local communities as well. And yeah, shout out to Pleb Lab. So yeah, Matt, thanks so much, man. This is a great conversation. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate you. Thanks for having me.